Welcome to Podcast Against Antisemitism, the show that takes a deep dive into the world's oldest hatred. I'm Ellie, your host, and you can join us for new episodes every Thursday. Subscribe now at antisemitism.org/podcast or wherever you get your podcasts to make sure you never miss a show. You can also watch the podcast on our YouTube channel. And please consider leaving us a nice review so we can grow our listenership. It makes a big difference. My guest today is Tyler Samuels, a Canadian-based Sephardic Jamaican Jew whose educational Jewish history content focuses on the Jews of the Caribbean and Canada. His content, posted to the Instagram account Blunt Black Jew, also debunks common myths and conspiracies and offers positive videos centered around Jewish and Black pride. Tyler has also previously served as program coordinator for the Tel Aviv Institute, an organization that aims to tackle and depoliticize antisemitism online, and he is the co-founder of the group Jews of Color Canada. Tyler, thank you so much for joining us. How are you?
Thank you for having me. I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. I'm really excited to have you on. You know, as mentioned, we spoke a bit before, the Jews of the Caribbean is not really something that we've talked much about, so I'm really, really excited to get into it. Before we do that, I want to find out a bit more about you and who you are. So as mentioned, you are a Canadian-based Sephardic Jamaican Jew. Could you tell us a bit about your own roots and what your Jewish upbringing looked like?
So my parents came to this country, Canada, over probably 20, 30 years ago with most of my family. And Judaism wasn't really a thing for us. And so I grew up not really knowing my heritage, my identity as strongly as, let's say, other Canadian Jews would have. And what struck a chord for me to, you know, actually get into my Judaism, get into this identity that I love, happened in high school. It was a world religions class, and everyone was asking about Judaism because that week we were talking about Judaism. And they're looking at me. They're pointing at me, asking me all these questions, and a lot of the time I couldn't answer because I didn't know, because I was so far removed from that part of my identity. And looking back at it now, it was upsetting because what followed afterwards was anti-Semitism in my high school. But now, looking back on it again and educating myself about who I am, that was one of the most impactful moments of my childhood or life, where I had to really think about, as a Jew, what does this mean? What does this identity mean to me? What does this hold to me? And especially being a Jamaican Jew and that ancestry and that history. So I based my life around that. And it's been interesting. It's been an interesting couple of years dealing with both Black and Jewish identities, because a lot of people think that we don't exist when we do, and that's within both the Jewish world and the non-Jewish world. And so, especially in Canada, you stand out more than you would, let's say, in the United States or in Jamaica, where Jamaican Jews are incredibly diverse, to the point of there will be Jews who look like me there, there will be Jews who look like you there, there will be Jews that look entirely different from the both of us. But that's the legacy of Caribbean Jewry and Jamaican Jews, I should say.
You mentioned a moment ago that when it came to high school, there was a bit of anti-Semitism. Could you tell us a bit more about that?
Wonderful years of my life. Honestly, I didn't actually understand why it exploded as it did, because plenty of people in my high school knew I was Jewish. they're okay with it. And then all of a sudden one day, people just started bringing up Christ Killer. Whenever they would mention Jews or me, the Christ Killer thing, oh, Jews killed Jesus Christ and everything. And then it started escalating. And it was becoming much more common. And a lot of people, I guess, would say, you know, why didn't you act on this? Why didn't you do anything? And a lot of people don't understand. High school for me was 2008 and 2012. And completely different era as it is now. Like growing up, like I heard racism, I heard anti-Semitism, especially in elementary school. It wasn't just, oh, go to the principal's office and report it. For me, in most of the cases, I would say, well, you know, this is life. You have to deal with it on your own. You have to sit down with your classmates and talk about why this upset you. There wasn't really action by school administration to actually crack down on this. So in high school, like when I would go to the vice principal's office, it was not taken seriously for me. For other Jews at this the school, I figured it was taken much more seriously, and it was because, in my opinion, they probably don't think I am Jewish because I'm black. And yeah, it's weird, and like there were only probably 4 or 5 Jewish students at this high school of over 2,000. But it was because of that, I thought at least, that whenever I complained about anti-Semitism to school administration, it wasn't taken seriously. So the Christ Killer thing happened. Like typical slurs, like money and pennies and all that happened. Where people would tell that to me. And I started to develop a thick skin. Because if no one was going to act to protect me, I had to do it on my own. And I remember, I couldn't wait to graduate high school, get into university. There would be this huge Jewish community, and I would never have to experience that again. However, that is very that was a very wishful thinking dream, because that did not happen. But yeah, it definitely prepared me as I moved up in life, because not a lot of Jews experienced that, especially here in Ontario. A lot of Jews live within areas of Ontario where there is a large Jewish population in the cities where they reside. So they go to Jewish day school, and majority Jewish, neighbors probably majority Jewish. And then when they get to university, they're taken aback because they have never experienced that. That's not the full Jewish Canadian experience, but talking to a lot of my Jewish friends, they who grew up in this situation, it was a complete culture shock when they got to university, because they were not used to just this blatant hatred. So yeah, it was interesting in high school.
Yeah, you know, we hear that a lot, and it's a real, real shame. You know, we speak to a lot of Jewish people who go to Jewish schools. You run a lot of educational programs, and then they sort of go into the wider world. They leave the Jewish community for the first time, for some of them, and they experience a lot of anti-Semitism, and it's a bit of a shock. Like, oh, what is this? You know. And, but that's what we're here for. We're here to help and protect them. But It is a shame when that happens. And the denial of the existence of black Jews today is still staggering to me. To you, it may not be. You may be like, well, I'm very used to this. But from my perspective, I'm sort of like, still, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's a challenging thing, honestly, because it's like there is a history. There's a documented history of black Jews, whether they're from the States, the Caribbean, Africa. So there's really no, for me at least, there's really no excuse in 2023 where this type of thinking continues, but it does. It does, unfortunately.
Let's talk about the history of the Jews in the Caribbean, because a lot of your content touches upon this. And this is something that I personally don't know loads about. And I'd be really, really interested to hear more from you.
Okay, so basically it has everything to do with the Inquisition, the Spanish and Portuguese Inquisition. So what primarily happened was in the Caribbean, there were islands that were colonized by, let's say, the Dutch or the British. Those islands were bases of refuge. So Jews who were forcibly converted fled, or when they were expelled from either Spain or Portugal, they fled to these islands. Jamaica is a very strange case. It's a very strange case because when Portuguese Jews started coming to Jamaica, it was technically still controlled by the Spanish. We don't really know why this was allowed. Some of the theories say that because Jamaica was conquered by Christopher Columbus, his family somehow turned a blind eye because the ownership of the island passed towards his family after his death. And the story goes, they didn't allow the Inquisition into Jamaica, even though the Inquisition was in the Spanish Caribbean. So Haiti, Dominican Republic, and so on. But with Jamaica, these Portuguese, like they knew there were Jews, secret Jews on the island. So in a lot of the historical texts where you see the Spanish talking about Jamaica, they make comments about these Portuguese. They're not true Christians. They use the M slur to describe them a lot of the time. They just disparage them. And so what happened was the Spanish Inquisition was supposed to go into Jamaica to investigate. And what happened, this was what happened around the 1600s, 1630s. What we assume happened was a lot of these Portuguese Jews contacted first the Dutch to see if they would invade Jamaica, because a lot of these Portuguese Jews had relatives in the Netherlands. The Dutch kind of refused, said no. So they turned to the next best thing, which was England. And England launched an invasion. And from some historical documents, we can see that a lot of these Portuguese Jews had a direct role in aiding English soldiers, telling them exact pinpoints of the Spanish throughout Jamaica. And when the English were successful, liberated the island, we then saw a wave of Sephardic Jews coming into Jamaica. The Portuguese Jews that were already there embraced their Judaism openly. Port Royal, which was the major capital of Jamaica up until an earthquake destroyed it, was the center of Jamaican Jewish life. So we don't really have a lot of evidence, because a lot of the historical records, Jewish records from that era, was destroyed in this earthquake. And it basically, Port Royal collapsed into the sea after the earthquake. So totally gone, most of it. But we know probably there was a synagogue there. They had interactions with privateers that were based in Jamaica, English pirateers. And then we get the whole story of Jewish pirates of the Caribbean, which was a thing. There were pirates, Jewish pirates operating in the Caribbean, or privateers. And they worked with the English. They worked with the Dutch. Anyone who was against the Spanish or Portuguese. The most famous one was Moses Cohen Henriquez. He worked with the Dutch first, and then he switched sides to work with Captain Henry Morgan, who most people outside, I guess, Jamaica and Britain, they recognize him as the rum, Captain Henry's, Captain Morgan rum, because that his name right. after that. Yeah. So he settled in Jamaica, and he was one of the Jews who really established Jewish life in Jamaica. And there's a whole lot more history of this, but this is basically like the detail, the small fine details of this history.
Wow. Is there still Jewish life in Jamaica today?
Yeah. I have asked this question more times than anything else to do with Jamaican Jews. Yes, there is a thriving Jewish community in Jamaica. The synagogue in Kingston that has been there for, this synagogue has been there for over 100 years. It's a combined synagogue. So Sephardic and Ashkenazi, Minhag and rites and all so forth. So it's thriving. They have their own Facebook page. If you go on the Facebook page, they're always busy doing something. So that's in Kingston. And then in Montego Bay, Chabad set up their Chabad synagogue center there. So that caters to both the locals and Jews who travel there for vacation or Israelis that work there. But yeah, Jewish life in Jamaica is very strong. And there's a misconception that, oh, this is just history and they no longer exist like other parts in the Caribbean. I would say wrong. Yeah, on both in Jamaica and the rest of the Caribbean. Because it's flourishing, it's alive. We may not know the exact numbers of how many Jews in Jamaica there are today. But they're always having Shabbat services every single week. Nice. So if that doesn't tell you something, then
yeah,
I don't know what will.
And has Jewish life in the Caribbean pretty much been localized to Jamaica, or was there stuff going on in some of the surrounding islands?
So no. So in Barbados, there was a Jamaican Jewish community, Carajo, Trinidad and Tobago, Grenada. All these islands had or have a Jewish presence. A lot of them still have the synagogues there. Like, for example, the U.S. Virgin Islands has one of the oldest synagogues in the Caribbean, and it's still in operation. The community is strong there. The difference with the Caribbean is it was all connected historically. Jewish life was always connected. For an example, there was a moral named Moses. Forget his last name, even though I did a whole entire thing about him, actually. He, in the 1800s, he was the one moral of the Caribbean, of the Jewish Caribbean. So he traveled, he island hopped constantly performing ritual circumcision for the community, because If you had a family and your wife gave birth to a son and you needed a circumcision, a Brit, to happen, what are you going to do? Send a letter to the Netherlands or Britain or the America, and look how long that will take you. Months. So yeah. With this guy, he did it all over the region. So he went from Jamaica to Carico, to Barbados, to Virgin Islands, probably Bahamas, all sorts of areas where he performed this service. So it was always connected, even though it was different. Like, each Jewish Caribbean experience is different on every island. And what I mean by that, for example, for Barbados, they went through a lot of oppression and persecution under a British colonial government. Apparently, there was even a ghetto established for them at one point. Jamaica, completely different experience. Discrimination, a lot of it economic discrimination, the same with Barbados, but it went further in Barbados. And then in other islands, there was much more tolerance. But I think the greatest connection is it was all connected. Jewish families were all connected throughout the Caribbean, and also the economic discrimination that isn't really talked about. Like, yes, they had some rights, but whether they were living under Dutch or British or even French colonial rule, they always had to fight for the little bit, teeny bit of human rights when they had gone through so much of the Inquisition and then descendants of that facing that. So,
right. Now, much has been documented on the relationships between Jews and Muslims and Jews and Christians. But I was wondering, could you tell us anything about the relationship between Jews and Rastafarians?
So, it's an interesting topic. I love talking about it. I would say the strongest connection would be if you listen to a lot of Rastafarian reggae, they use similar religious undertones and terms. So, returning to Zion for us means returning to Israel. For a lot of Rastafarians, Zion means Ethiopia. And so, like Bob Marley's song, which a lot of Jews love to use on Instagram, Iron Lion Zion, it has, yes, it's connected. It has that Jewish undertone. But what he's really talking about is returning to Ethiopia. Haile Selassie, if you know anything about Rastafarianism, that's what they're talking about. However, that return, they also felt connected to the Jewish experience because by the rivers of Babylon, which the psalm was turned into a reggae song in the early 60s, and then Boney M, that very famous band, made it a very international song, by the rivers of Babylon. They embraced that. They said, okay, the Jews were expelled, sent to Babylon, they're weeping for their homeland. We also face the same thing. We were expelled from Africa, we are sent here, we want to return back. And that is the greatest connection, because Rastafarians viewed our suffering and said, we suffered the same thing.
Wow.
And so those songs and the return to Zion and so on and so forth, that's how it's connected with Judaism in a way. And it's not surprising that, like if you listen to interviews of Ziggy Marley, everyone says, oh, Ziggy is married to an Israeli woman. Okay, we know, thank you, I know. But he mentions it that my mother and father emphasize the importance of Jews in Israel to us. And if we look at the connection between Rastafarianism and Judaism, that doesn't surprise me. And then it also doesn't surprise me that there's this myth that, you know, Bob Marley was either Jewish or his father was Jewish. For the last time I'll say this, there is no concrete evidence that Bob Marley's father was Jewish. Is it a possibility? 100% yes, because there are many Jamaicans who probably do have Jewish ancestry. But there's no concrete evidence of Bob Marley. But that's the beautiful thing, that because he expressed this love for Judaism,
yeah,
as what Ziggy says, a lot of Jews feel connected to Bob Marley. And I think that's a good thing too. And I think there should be more outreach between both communities and really celebrate and, you know, build connections, build bonds with one another, because we are similar. We're not the same, but we're very similar in how we view the world. And like with Rastafarians, they deal with a lot of oppression, especially in Jamaica, because their religious beliefs are not necessarily respected by the government. Like, there was a case where a court case said that a school could cut the dreadlocks of a student who was Rastafarian. So it's they have the same sort of, not the same, but similar aspects of their religious and cultural identity that they can relate to Jews when it comes to oppression and persecution. That isn't a long history, but yeah, definitely there's
that's
a connection.
Very interesting. No, I didn't really know any of that. That's fascinating. And I, by the way, I can't help but feel that you've been asked that Bob Marley thing so many times. For the last time, people, I'm telling this one more time. Stop asking.
It is asked, or people mention it to me constantly. And it's like, okay, possibility, no concrete evidence.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, I appreciate the interest.
We get so excited when we think a famous person might be Jewish.
Exactly.
Oh my gosh. Now let's go on to a very important matter, which is food. You posted an Instagram video which showed you making escovitch fish, and you spoke of the influence that Jamaican Jews have had on Jamaican cuisine. Now, could you tell us a bit more about this?
So, the first thing is first. A lot of people outside of Jamaica or the Jamaican diaspora, even though that's an iffy thing to say, they view Jamaica as this black majority country. It's a black country. Jamaica may have a black majority, but it is not a black nation. Jamaica is a multicultural, multi-ethnic, multi-religious country. So with cuisine, Jamaican cuisine is diverse from each sector, from the Chinese Jamaican community, from the white Jamaican community, from the black Jamaican community, from the Jewish Jamaican community. And another thing is, we don't usually call ourselves as black Jamaican or Jewish Jamaican. It's just Jamaican. We're Jamaican.
Right.
So with cuisine, Estevich fish, it came from Portugal. And people wondering, how did that happen? Portuguese Jews brought to Jamaica because that's right. What they ate. Saltfish and ackee, which is the national dish of Jamaica. Saltfish is a thing in Portugal. Where did that come from? Portuguese Jews. Ackee came from West Africa. I'm pretty sure that came from West Africa. So it's a fusion. It's a fusion of cuisine. There's a never, it's a Jamaican dessert called guisada. It's basically a hard shell pastry, and then you have coconut filling in it. That is a Portuguese dessert. Portuguese Jews brought that to Jamaica, and now every Jamaican you know will eat it. It's in every Caribbean store in the diaspora. I eat it often. So those things, and most people don't even realize this. Oh my God. Like, I've had so many people ask me this. Or I say this, oh my God, I never knew this was Jewish. It is, but because of how diverse Jamaica is, these foods are just typical Jamaican foods.
Yeah.
And that's how Jamaican Jews brought that cuisine, infused it into the national cuisine, and now it's widespread. So that fish, brought into Jamaica by Jews. Mm. Most Jamaicans are Christian. Every Easter, they have that recipe, or they eat it whenever.
Yeah.
And that's how wonderful that has brought into Jamaican society. And I think that's the beautiful thing about the history of Jamaican Jews is some assimilated, but they still retain their Jewish identity, but also assimilated to Jamaican identity, Jamaican culture. And that's what makes the community so unique, both in Jamaica and in diaspora. And that cuisine, first of all, it's a wonderful cuisine. Jamaican food is wonderful. It's amazing. I don't care what anyone says about that. It is wonderful. It's fantastic. But it also shows just how accepted Jamaican Jews have been in Jamaica from the early stages of when they came, where they faced discrimination, until late 1800s. The assembly, the House of Assemblies, closed on Yom Kippur because majority of the members were Jewish, until now, where it's rare to see anti-Semitism in Jamaica, but it's swiftly condemned when it does occur.
Really?
It's extremely rare to see anti-Semitism in Jamaica. Extremely rare. It does happen. It's happened before. But it's extremely rare. And that's, I think that's the beautiful experience. Because there was an interview of one of the very matriarchs of the community who died a couple of years ago. And to her, anti-Semitism was foreign. It was a foreign thing. And she went to school in Jamaica and she's like, I didn't experience this. I didn't experience anti-Semitism until I left Jamaica and gone to foreign, which is a patois thing. And she experienced it when she said she was Jewish. And it was like, it was a culture shock for her.
Wow.
So it's definitely a complete different diaspora experience. And with the culture and the cuisine, which, you know, nowadays a lot of people love to say Jews stole cuisine and all that. It's a happier experience that we've had as Jamaican Jews. Yeah. So, yeah.
Hey, if you want to stay up to date with the fight against anti-Semitism, why not subscribe to Campaign Against Anti-Semitism? Visit antisemitism.org/act or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or YouTube. Now, let's go to a different country, which you also post quite a bit about, that being Canada, where you currently live. It has a very sizable Jewish population. How did this come to be? How did Canada become such a popular destination for Jews?
It's an interesting thing because throughout Canadian history, they've always tried to prevent us from immigrating into this country. And it goes back to when it wasn't even Canada. It was a French colony. So the French in Quebec, they banned Jews from coming into their colony. There was a famous case. Her name was Esther, forget her last name. But she had to pretend that she was a man and a Christian to come in. And when they found out she was not only a woman, but Jewish, the last recorded historical fact that we have about her was she was deported out of France after numerous efforts to get her to convert to Christianity. So it's always been this historical legacy of not wanting us, but it's always been we want to come. And usually it always has to do with persecution. So different waves. The earliest waves were from Eastern Europe, Russia, all those other countries in Eastern Europe, especially came en masse. Just like in the United States, it happened with Canada. Then you start seeing the Canadian government crack down on this because the Canadian government had a policy for a very long time where they only wanted people who were farmers, the working class, and domestics, white domestics. They did not view Jews as white. And that's very something that's very controversial nowadays when you have arguments with people debating back and forth about this. But for the Canadian government, for decades, they did not view Jews as white. So it was difficult because they needed agricultural labor. So what they did was they classified Jews as a trading class, which meant that they're more into business than agriculture. So we don't want them. They wouldn't make good farmers. There were instances where Jews did get into the country. They established Jewish communities across Canada. But the overwhelming efforts by the Canadian government was to stop them from entering. And most of those Jews, early Jews, came in due to persecution, fleeing persecution. And like there have been waves of Jewish immigration over the years from North Africa, Holocaust survivors, so on and so forth. But that's primarily the history. It's always been a struggle between the authorities in here and Jews trying to escape persecution for a better life.
Right. Right. And as a Jewish person who's living in Canada now, in your opinion, what are some of the challenges that Jewish Canadians are facing today?
I would say a very insidious nature of anti-Semitism, where it takes on two roles. One, it's extremely violent. So a couple of summers ago, there was a guy who was walking around shirtless with a swastika on his chest, attacking Jews, asking if they're Jewish, and then attacking them. And then on the other hand, we have the insidious nature within our government systems. There was recently a scandal where there was a man who was supposed to be doing equity and diversity training within the Ministry of Historical or Cultural, something, Ministry of Culture, Federal Ministry of Culture. Turns out he was a raving anti-Semite. His tweets, everything, raving anti-Semite, and the Canadian government gave him a very large sum of money. And it became into a huge mess where there was a parliamentary investigation about this. I think it's still ongoing. Those type of things. And it's like, to us, it's almost like, is the Canadian government not vetting people that they hire or employ to do things concerning equity and diversity on a federal level? Are they not investigating these people who will then turn out to be raving anti-Semites? So for us, it's basically, unless there is noise towards this anti-Semitism that we make or the media makes, which is rare, it's always washed under the bridge. And I think that's the greatest fear for Canadian Jews, is that the government, especially provincial governments, are not doing enough to combat anti-Semitism. Only a few provinces in Ontario have embraced the IRA definition of anti-Semitism. Only a few of them. Okay. And only a few of these provinces have mandated Holocaust studies. I think that it should be anti-Semitism studies instead of Holocaust studies, because it's just wide encompassing, that you need to include everything alongside the Holocaust. For example, Ontario recently adopted this, so Holocaust studies is now mandated in this province that I live in, and it's shocking because you know, it's anti-Semitism didn't happen a couple of years ago. The Holocaust did not happen a year ago. It's been over, 80 plus years since the Holocaust? 2,000, 4,000 years of anti-Semitism? And it's just now, 2023, that this education here has been mandated. So there's a lot of worry. There's a lot of anxiety for Canadian Jews. I feel it. As a Canadian Jew, I feel it myself.
Sure. No, that sounds very concerning. Let's go to anti-Semitism in Canada on campus. Now, I read that whilst you were studying at the University of Toronto, you decided, I don't know how long, but you decided to stop wearing your kippah because you kept getting harassed or stopped. That sounds particularly unpleasant. I'm very sorry that happened to you. Would you mind, if you're happy to do so, telling us what exactly happened there?
So, if this is the article you read that I'm thinking you're talking about, because there have been several concerning my campus at U of T. What had happened was my campus, they have a very interesting history of anti-Semitism, anti-Israel rhetoric, BDS, which has all been combined into anti-Semitism. Make no mistake about that. So what would happen back then was their Israel apartheid week was very brutal. And I mean brutal in the fact that many of the people organizing this event knew I was Jewish. And so what happened was they would stop me in the hall. They had their paper mache or apartheid wall, and they would stop me and start demanding, you know, admit that Israel is an apartheid state, yada, yada, yada. Like, you need to sign this. And I'm like, I'm just going to class, man. I don't care. Like, you can, I disagree with you. You can say what you want. I'm not going to stop you. But you don't see me doing the same thing about terrorism in Israel perpetrated by Hamas or Islamic Jihad. You don't see me doing that to you. But they had the audacity to stop me because they saw the kippah too. So they, even if they didn't know I was Jewish personally, they saw the kippah, so they knew. And they would stop me. And it's interesting. On the one hand, they love to say that Judaism has no connection to Israel. But when it comes to talking about BDS, suddenly Jews must answer for everything the Israeli government does now. It's ironic, but it's the truth. And so I decided at that point in time, I'm tired of this. I'm exhausted. Because in 2012, when I first got there, they passed their first out of many BDS motions. And it was anti-Semitism that I have never seen, even in universe, in high school, where people would mock me in Tim Horton's lines, which is a restaurant in Canada at our campus. They would mock Jews wearing kippahs. They would say anti-Semitic things. And it's like, I don't want to deal with this. I'm just here to get my degree. So I stopped wearing my kippah because of that. And it was getting, for me, it was getting dangerous because every time we would ask the university administration to step in, we are dying here. We are struggling to survive as Jewish students on this campus because not just the Palestinian club who's pushing this BDS, it's the student union who is making this environment increasingly hostile to us. And like we had a Jewish club on campus and we tried, but it was getting to a point where we needed the school administration to step in. Because Jews like myself who wore kippahs, they didn't want to wear kippahs anymore. You had some Jews transferring campuses to the main campus and because they were tired of it. And every time the school administration, from my perspective and me dealing with them at the time, it was like they ignored it. At one point, there was a Jewish student who was attending this this event, anti-Israel event on my campus. And first, one of the questions was, is anyone here Jewish? And is anyone here supporter of Israel? She raised her hand. They chased her out of the room. They verbally harassed her. They chased her out. And then they basically victim blamed her and said, well, why did you put up your hand to answer those questions then? And the thing was, that doesn't make sense. Why did you create an environment that was so hostile that a student let's get that straight, a student who was Jewish had to leave the room because she was being chased out by your attendees with slurs being thrown. So if people may ask why I may have taken off my kippah, because the environment at that point was so bad that it was unbearable. And I'd rather taken my personal security much more seriously than at that moment wear a kippah. Obviously that has changed because I wear a kippah every day, everywhere, in public, whatever, what have you. But at that point in my life, I was scared. I was intimidated. And especially when the Jewish community on my campus, on that campus, was like 10, 15 people.
Yeah.
There's no will to be the only Jew that stands out in that kind of environment. So, yeah.
Well, look, I mean, to be honest, who could blame you? It sounds like an absolutely terrifying position to be in. I'm really sorry that happened. That sounds absolutely horrible. I want to talk a bit about what you've done since. Now, you are instrumental in the group Jews of Color Canada. What is this group and what has your involvement been?
So I was one of the co-founders with one of my dear friends, Rivka Campbell, who was also a Jamaican Jew here in Canada. We decided to create it because really and truly, a lot of Jews in Canada do not look like us. And there are a lot of people within our community, within the Jewish community, that have a hard time with the Jew of Color label because they see it as anyone who does not fit that label is white. And I somewhat agree and I somewhat disagree. Jews should be able to identify as however they choose to identify as Jews. So for me personally, I don't really call myself a Jew of color. I don't. I'm a Black Jew or a Sephardic Jew, a Jamaican Jew, whatever, Canadian Jew, whatever. That's what I identify as. But when we started, we wanted to push Jews who look like us into these spaces where we are not being heard or visibly shown. And a lot of people are asking why. We're all Jews. Well, take, for example, synagogue security. Because of the rise of anti-Semitism, we've had to have security and police protect our places of worship. Not everyone on that police force or security knows there are Black Jews or Jews that don't look like the stereotypical Jewish person they see in media settings. What will happen if there is a security guard or police guard that sees me coming into a synagogue, stops me, questions me, and it turns into a situation?
Has that happened to you?
Yeah. It has. It has happened to me. It has happened to many other Black Jews, especially in the States too, where they will be stopped and interrogated. Why are you here? I'm Jewish. I'm here to go to synagogue services. And it's a doubt because a lot of non-Jews, and I always tell this to people, it is a privilege to think that every non-Jew has met a Jew in their life. Unless they live in the city, and even then, that is a stretch in some cases. A lot of non-Jews have never seen a Jewish person unless it's in media or based upon stereotypes. So our original goal was, first, was to build a community of Jews that look like us as a support group. But then we realized there's a lot of problems within the Jewish community and the non-Jewish community on this issue. And so we've done education events where we talk about Jews across the world to young Canadian Jews here, where you say not every Jew has a diaspora community in Europe. there are diaspora communities in North Africa, in Ethiopia, in the Caribbean, in China, in Asia. Everywhere on earth, there has been a Jewish diaspora community. And our mission has always been to emphasize that. But it's also been to emphasize non-Jews in realizing that there is no such thing as a Jewish look. There may be people who think there is, you know, stereotypically the facial features like large noses and all that. Not every Jew has that. Not every Jew does. And for me, I have a hard time accepting the facial features thing because it just reminds me of horrible stereotypes. But there's still ongoing belief that Jews have this one look. And that's far from the case. And people need to understand that Jews on a spectrum are an extremely diverse ethnic religious group. Extremely diverse. And I always use the example of Jamaica. There are Ashkenazi Jamaican Jews who look like me. There are Sephardic Jamaican Jews who do not look like me. But it's that diverse. And it may not look like that in certain places in North America or Britain or Australia or New Zealand but in other places where there's a sizable Jewish majority or population, I should say, diversity. So that's what we've done with our organization here in Canada, at least try to break those myths and show what all Jews look like, I should say. And we should embrace that as a community and tell the non-Jewish community, we don't want your stereotypes and we don't want your labels. We know who we are. We know who our people are. We know our diversity. If you don't listen, that's fine, but you're not going to speak for us. And that's what we've tried to do.
Most definitely. All right. Now, Tyler, I am going to ask you a question that I ask all of our guests, which is, if someone who is not Jewish approaches you and says that they want to help in the fight against anti-Semitism, what should they do?
I've had this question asked by me by tons of people, tons of non-Jewish people. And the first thing I always say is, if you listen to other ethnic groups when they talk about their experiences with discrimination, and you say, okay, that we need to solve that, you need to extend the same favor to Jews. Too many people have taken this line of, well, you know, this Jewish person over here says differently. Okay, that's their experience. But if I'm telling you my experience as a Jewish person, I don't want to hear you mentioning your Jewish friend said this or your Jewish friend said that. And there's a wide spectrum of the community, and I'm pretty sure a wide spectrum of that Jewish community would agree with me with what they consider anti-Semitic and what they don't consider anti-Semitic. And probably 10 times out of 10, we'll all agree on what is definitely anti-Semitic. That is one of the first things I need someone to acknowledge who's a non-Jew. Asking that question. Do you have bias when a Jewish person talks about anti-Semitism? If you do, you need to examine that bias and ask yourself why. Second, educate yourself on what the definition of anti-Semitism is. There are too many people who love to use the whole, well, you know, anti-Semitism means Semitic people, all that foolishness. No. No. Historically, it was a German term invented by a German anti-Semitic writer. He made it to talk about Jewish people because he wanted them gone out of Germany. That is the purpose of the term anti-Semitism. Third, actually, I guess study it. Study, talk about it. It didn't start and end at the Holocaust, which a lot of educators, a lot of especially non-Jewish educators and non-Jews think is the case. No, This is a 4,000-year-old hatred stemming back to the Torah. Like, I know some people are like, oh, religion. Exodus. These people may rise up against us. We need to take them out. Dual loyalties, which is a common anti-Semitic trope. It was in the Torah. It's now mainstream 4,000 years later. And this is a very old hatred. And I think a lot of people need to understand that. And a lot of people I've dealt with, I've talked to, some of them have said, well, you Jews bring it upon ourselves. How did we bring it upon ourselves? Oh, I don't know. I can't answer. Then why did you say it? You need to research about the history of anti-Semitism first before you say those statements. So I always challenge people to look at their biases, their preconceived notions about anti-Semitism, about Jews, even about Israel, because 9 out of 10 times, complete bias, they have no idea what they're talking about, or they're not educated whatsoever, and they just make assumptions. Mm. Do I think those people are anti-Semitic? 50-50. 50% yes, 50% no. Not everyone is anti-Semitic. They just believe things. And I feel that as a historian, as I guess an online educator now, we need to deconstruct these ideas rather than just say, well, anti-Semitic, whatever. No, you have to explain how this is anti-Semitic, how this is a historical trope. Because, like I said, it is a privilege most non-Jews don't know. Is that an excuse? No. But that's the reality. And we need to explain why this is anti-Semitic so they understand. So they can't say, well, I didn't know this. No. Here's the information for you in a very easily accessible way, with pictures and small, large print. There's some education for you, which you can use to expand upon. So that's what I try and do when people ask me that question.
I think that's very sensible. Tyler, tell the listeners, what have you got going on and where can people find you?
So first things first, they can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Blunt Black Jew. I am trying once again to get into TikTok. I can't stand the app, but I might start continuing to use it. And secondly, what I've been doing is I've been trying to move away from just focusing on creating online content. I've been trying to, I guess, go more mainstream to reach more people outside of the Jewish bubble that I have. I want to get a lot of this information into the hands of non-Jews. So I've partnered with a few organizations here to make video content that we're hopefully going to spread to non-Jews in Canada, and to talk about not just anti-Semitism, but how anti-Semitism affects Black Jews, because a lot of people don't understand there's a difference. There's a difference of how we are treated by anti-Semites, and it sometimes transcends anti-Semitism to just plain old racism, anti-Black racism, or sometimes both. So we're trying to figure out how to do this to educate Jews, non-Jews, non-Jewish educators when it comes to anti-Semitism in Canada, especially. So that's what I'm hopefully get done soon.
That sounds like some pretty great work. Tyler Samuels, thank you so much for joining me on Podcast Against Anti-Semitism.
Thank you.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Podcast Against Antisemitism. If you did, please subscribe and leave us a nice rating, or email any feedback to podcast@antisemitism.org. Until next Thursday, stay safe.